From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been nearly 25 years since National Public Radio first went on the air. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear an excerpt of the very first broadcast of All Things Considered, and we'll look back on some of NPR's history with Linda Wertheimer, co-host of All Things Considered. She directed the first broadcast of the program, May 3, 1971, when the lead story was anti-war demonstrators filling the streets of Washington while tear gas filled the air. Wertheimer has also served as NPR's congressional and political correspondent. Wertheimer has edited a new collection of NPR's broadcast pieces called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on NPR. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. See if you recognize this.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
That's how All Things Considered began its very first broadcast on May 3, 1971. The host was Robert Conley. We'll hear a report from that broadcast a little later. My guest voice will be more familiar to you than Conley's. Linda Wertheimer has been hosting All Things Considered since 1989. She actually directed the first broadcast of the show. After helping to shape NPR for nearly 25 years, she's put some of its history between the covers of a book. It's called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation as Heard on National Public Radio, and it features news stories, interviews, and commentaries. Before hosting All Things Considered, Linda was NPR's congressional and political correspondent. I asked her to share some memories of directing that first broadcast of All Things Considered.
Well, from my personal remembrance of it is of just being terrified. I was completely terrified. That the tape wouldn't get there, that everything that could go wrong would go wrong, that we wouldn't make the air, that there would be horrible big black holes in the middle of the program, none of which happened. But things were late and things were very rough, and they continued to be very rough for some time to come. But the first day, I came to work on a bus, and it was, you know, this time of year. There were beautiful flowers in Washington. It was a beautiful spring day, and there was so much tear gas in the air that you just choked on it because there were anti-war demonstrations in Washington. And it was a weekday demonstration to shut the Capitol down, to close the bridges and prevent traffic from getting in and just completely mess up the Capitol City for the day. And that was the day we went on the air.
How did you cover what was happening in Washington?
Well, we sent reporters who, you know, untried, untested, unknown quantity type, quantity things. I mean, we of course, we knew them, and we had done pilots and so on. But it was, you know, this was the real thing. Reporters went racing out with tape recorders to try to get a real flavor of the day, to record lots of interviews, to record the sounds, to just speak into the tape recorders their reactions to what they were seeing and their descriptions of what they were seeing, to make it as immediate as possible. So that was the assignment. About six people hit the streets with tape recorders, going in all sorts of directions, and they brought it back. And then we tried to, to slash and cram it into the program.
The line of young people is just come across the highway. Traffic is stopped. And here come the police. One, two, three, four police on motor scooters. One demonstrator knocked down by a motor scooter policeman. Anger now. Anger of the young people. And here come more police.
Come on, people!
The demonstrators just told a motorcycle sergeant that one of his men did knock one of the demonstrators down.
All right, where? Let me get an ambulance down here for you. Motor 3 on the Southwest Freeway. Have one injured down here. Could you send me an ambulance, please? It's right at Main Avenue.
And he hit the kid. He went right through the line.
That guy passed me and almost knocked me down. And the blue...
Yeah, but it's policeman we're talking about.
Policeman. A motorcycle hit him. Not a citizen.
Right there. The man over there. Right there.
Sergeant, excuse me. Jeff Kamen, National Public Radio. Is that a technique where the men actually try to drive the bikes into the demonstrators?
No, it's no technique. We're trying to go down the road and the people...
How did listening back to this tape when you were editing the book compare to your memories of that day?
You know, what I remember of the day was the confusion and the fright that we wouldn't make it and concern about how it was going to sound and so on. But listening to it, what amazed me was that it's pretty good. You know, it's very rough and it's very it's confusing. But then so was the day confusing. You don't get a lot of details about names and times of day and that sort of thing. But what you do get is a very strong feeling about what it was like to be out there. Now, that's our stock in trade still. That's what we still try to do. And I think that when we succeed, you know, that's the best thing that we do, is just put you right into an event.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and as you know, she's a host of All Things Considered, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. And it includes highlights of 25 years of reports on NPR. I want to get to an interview of your own that you've included in the new book, Listening to America. This is an interview that you did in 1992 with Ross Perot. You did this interview because of something that you knew about from when you were covering the House Ways and Means Committee back in 1975.
Yes.
Tell us what you knew that you wanted to ask Ross Perot about.
Well, this was a story which was broken back in the 70s by the Wall Street Journal. During the course of a drafting of a tax bill, an amendment was added to the bill. It was a provision which enabled... It was a version of loss carryback. It enabled a person or a small group of people who had large gains and large losses within a certain period of years to balance one against the other, to even out their tax burdens. You know, they'd get big deductions one year and have to pay very heavy taxes in another year to sort of average that out. Since it was designed to only hit a few taxpayers between a certain number of years, it was, you know, a so-called tall blonde man with one black shoe amendment, specially designed amendment. So everybody knew this had to be a favor for somebody. And the Wall Street Journal had the capacity to do the research. They just simply asked their research department, find me a taxpayer who has had huge gains in this period and then huge losses in this period. And... you know, do you have anybody that meets that criteria? And the computer came up, Ross Perot. So they broke the story that Ross Perot had caused to be inserted into a House bill an amendment which would have resulted in a multimillion-dollar tax refund for him.
So this is what you wanted to confront him with?
So, yes, because... on the theory that some people have personal problems that don't bear the light of day, and that various candidates were having various kinds of difficulties with things in their personal history. So what I asked him was, do you think that the kind of, you know, piratical, although entirely legal, activities of big business are going to be any more palatable to the voting public than some of these extraordinary, items in people's personal lives would be. So I just wanted to ask him about his business conduct, essentially.
Did you get a satisfactory answer?
Well, he got really mad. He basically lost his temper. And we put that on the air.
Let's hear what he said.
I assume this is the sole reason for your taped interview.
No,
and
no.
It's your classic setup. So now that you have, you know, whoever you're trying to do a favor for, you've done it. And I'm sure you had a smirk on your mouth as you got me into this. And now that since you misstated it totally, and I have given you the facts on it, what else would you like to know?
I would like to pursue it further, but let me just ask you.
What is your show, anyhow?
All Things Considered.
And is this a radio program?
It is. But let me ask
you. It's really a radio program. You're not just somebody calling in.
No, sir. No, sir.
Now, would you want to know more about it?
I'm just wondering if you think that business practices may be somewhat more difficult to explain than, say, personal behavior has been to explain for some other candidates.
I'm not going to worry about it for a minute, and I just assume that there will be days when people like you show up doing a favor for somebody, and you've done it.
Was there any debate after this interview about whether his comments to you, is this a real radio show, should be left in or edited out?
Well, my feeling was that when you're talking to somebody like Ross Perot, or like the President of the United States, or that there is nothing to be gained by editing the tape, and much to be gained by just leaving the whole thing there. Of course, so we didn't touch it. We didn't edit it at all. And the fact that he, you know, sort of leaped to the attack rather than answer the question, I thought, you know, meant something. And so we left it completely entire. Now, that meant that we left in that silly-sounding giggle of mine. That sort of nervous laugh. The person who was producing it did cut that out, and I told him to put it back because I wanted to be able to look at Ross Perot right in the eye and say that's what you said, in case he came back to us and tried to claim that it didn't happen that way.
When you were editing Listening to America, I know you went around to a lot of reporters and producers and said to them, what do you think the best stories are that should be included in the book? Is there one story that absolutely everybody mentioned?
There are a lot of stories, actually. There's like, I could make a short list of stories that many people mentioned. And, you know, one of the things that made our job difficult is that we tend, and because we are in radio, to remember the things that make a nice noise. You know, the pieces that have, for some reason, the very interesting sounds in them. And some of those just flat did not translate to the page, and some did. But among the stories that lots of people mentioned were was Father Cares, the story of Jonestown, the mass suicide at Jonestown, the Fall of Saigon, which was a fabulous documentary-type production based on a tape-recorded letter home from one of the helicopter pilots who participated in the evacuation of Saigon. And then there were characters that everybody said, well, Andre's got to be there, and Bailey White should be there, and Archie Harrison, who was the person whose life and death with AIDS, Patty Naimond, followed for a couple of years. You know, people mentioned personalities, public radio people that should be in.
I want to get back to the very beginning of All Things Considered. What were the resources you had when the show was just getting started?
Well, they were very tiny. In fact, a lot of what we did in those early days was to try to invent ways of doing things that did not, you know, when we just simply did not have the people.
Yeah, like what'd you come up with?
Well, we would call on the phone. We would, we would telephone news sources, or we would do. Susan Stamberg was always fond of sort of going around the edges of something. In a town where something big had happened, she would call a barbershop and ask them what they thought of it. She would call telephone operators sometimes. We used the BBC to cover stories internationally for us, and we used local stations where local stations were able to cover local stories. But it was some time before we were able to really, to send our own people out to do the kind of work that that we do today.
Linda, in your book, you write that you and Susan Stamberg often disagreed about politics, that you almost always find politics interesting, and that Susan rarely does. Did that affect how you each went at stories? Did you go look at stories differently?
Well, I wrote that around a piece that Susan filed about. It was an interview with Jimmy Carter's dentist. See, now that's typical of Susan, that she looks at Jimmy Carter and sees teeth and calls his dentist and has an interview with him, which I would, you know, I in my sort of straight political reporting mind would think was the daffiest idea. But then you read the interview and the dentist says that she says, is he a good patient? He says, a very good patient. He does everything I tell him. He comes for checkups 3 times a year. And Susan said, so everyone should come for checkups 3 times a year? And he said, no, actually, 2 times a year is enough, but he comes 3 times. And, of course, that was one of the things about President Carter. He just wanted to do everything more, you know, more carefully than anyone had ever done it. And he kept bogging down in the White House for that reason. And we can look back at that interview and see that we learned something.
Linda Wertheimer hosts All Things Considered. She edited the new NPR book, Listening to America. It will be published next month. Wertheimer will be back with us in the second part of our program. This is Fresh Air. I hope you're enjoying hearing about some of the history of National Public Radio. One of the most important ingredients in the growth of public radio has been listeners' financial support. We're in the middle of a fundraising week. As you know, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is facing cutbacks. So your support is particularly important now. Remember, every station has to pay a fee to become a member of NPR and to broadcast programs like All Things Considered Morning Edition and Fresh Air. Your station needs your help so it can continue to bring you the programs you rely on. I urge you to call now with a pledge. Thank you. Many stations are fundraising this week. For stations that are playing us uninterrupted, we're featuring a special series about some of the small record labels that helped shape today's music. The 70s were marked by disposable music, and nobody did it better than Casablanca Records. Rock critic Ed Ward reviews the house that gave us The Village People, Kiss, and Donna Summer.
I always thought the 70s were the nostalgia-proof decade. But today, the sounds of disco and 70s rock are stronger than ever, and rappers take samples from the funk masters of the decade and make them new. The 70s live, and in large part, we have Neil Bogart and the Casablanca label to thank. Bogart was the last of his breed, a schlockmeister for whom the hit was the thing. He started out in Philadelphia, running Cameo Parkway Records, and then, with a couple of his peers, started the Buddha label, which gave the world bubblegum music. In 1974, he struck out on his own and started Casablanca. His first signing was firmly in the Neil Bogart tradition, a hard rock band he'd found in New York that was hated by critics, but began selling records almost as soon as he started putting them out. Kiss may have played garbage, but it was easily marketable, highly commercial garbage. Bogart loved garbage, and he knew how to sell it. Prepackaged entertainment, not art, please, which was why disco's rise in the middle of the decade caught Neil's ear. When Jacques Moralia, a Eurotrash producer, walked into his office with the Village People, an interracial group in stupid costumes straight out of a gay comic book, he saw dollar signs, and Moralia didn't let him down.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, young man, pick yourself off the ground. I said, young man. Short on your dough, you can stay there, and I'm sure you will find many ways to have a good time. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA.
Europe was the source of much of Casablanca's success. Another European producer, Giorgio Moroder, had an American artist who'd been living in Germany with whom he'd recorded a ridiculously long song, Love to Love You, Baby, that consisted mostly of simulated orgasmic moaning over a disco beat. Bogart took the chance, released it, and turned Donna Summer into a star. Moroder eventually made a record with her that was one of the starting points for today's techno music. Bogart seemed to love con artists, so he and George Clinton were fated to meet. Clinton managed to sell him a group that was already signed to another label. Parliament was Clinton's band Funkadelic, under another name. It didn't matter. Although Casablanca couldn't sell them in the discos, black and white listeners got the Parliament message and took the band to the top. By the end of the decade, Casablanca was part of Polygram, one of the world's largest record companies. And one day the auditors noticed that Polygram was going broke, despite selling more records than anybody. Careful checking pointed to Casablanca as the source of the cash hemorrhage, and Bogart was tossed out. Undaunted, he started Boardwalk Entertainment and signed Joan Jett, but before it could get going properly, Bogart developed a blood disease and died. He left behind a legend, a decade of decidedly mixed music, and, not coincidentally, a financial mare's nest.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. His series continues tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Linda Wertheimer, co-host of All Things Considered. When she began working at NPR nearly 25 years ago, she was the show's director. She went on to cover Congress and politics for NPR. We'll talk about what it was like to start a career in broadcasting in an era when women were still told their voices lacked credibility. Linda Wertheimer has edited a new book of NPR reports, interviews, and commentaries from the past 25 years called Listening to America. Linda Wertheimer, coming up on Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and from Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Radio is an ephemeral medium. Linda Wertheimer has tried to make it more lasting. She went through NPR's archives and selected reports, commentaries, and interviews that illustrate how America and NPR have changed in the past 25 years. She collected those pieces in a book to be published next month. It's called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation as Heard on NPR. Linda Wertheimer hosts All Things Considered. She's been with NPR since the first broadcast of the show, which she directed nearly 25 years ago. I wanted to catch up on some of her history. Linda, you started covering Congress, and then you were a political correspondent for NPR. This was all in the early to mid-70s that you started doing that. Mm-hmm. You were in that first wave of women to cover politics for national broadcasting outlets. Women, I think, in broadcasting, women in radio, I should say, face something that, say, print reporters didn't face, which is that women were told their voices weren't authoritative enough.
Absolutely.
Did you run into that a lot in the early period of your career?
Well, when I'm trying to find jobs, yes. And the thing is that it's illegal to say that now. I mean, no personnel person or editor would dream of saying such a thing. But a number of people said it to me. I remember one in an office at NBC, a man told me that women weren't authoritative delivering the news. And then he also told me that a very talented woman, whose name I actually recognized, had been a researcher at NBC for 10 years and that I should really aspire to a career like hers. And I threw a fit in the floor right on the spot.
What'd you say?
I just started yelling at him. I said, how can you possibly imagine that 10 years as a researcher is an attractive prospect for anybody? How can you say that? But it was that was the way it was. It was perfectly all right for him to say that, and he was amazed that I, you know, had the temerity to think that it should be otherwise.
So what would you go for? I mean, you couldn't rely on the law because this wasn't.
It hadn't happened yet.
It hadn't happened yet. Consciousness raising usually isn't an effective tool when you're applying for a job. So when you blew up, what could you say?
Well, you know, all I could do was leave. There was nothing to do. I did get a job working at WCBS News Radio in New York, and I worked there, although...
On the air?
No, although they had a couple of women reporters, including two of the most aggressive women reporters working in New York at the time, Mary Pangalos and Liz Trotta. And they routinely would cut their voices out of the pieces that they reported. But I mean, those were women who would get into anything, go anywhere, do anything. I mean, they were incredibly brave and aggressive and ferocious. And you know, and they did all that. I mean, they spilled their blood and got their voices cut out because they weren't authoritative. I mean, the chief of police of New York City, if you had suggested to him that either one of those women was not authoritative, he would suggest to you that you were out of your mind. But because he had, you know, he had had a few experiences with them. But it was just a time. That's the way it was then.
Where was the first place where you actually got on the air?
National Public Radio. That was the first. And actually, I wasn't hired at NPR to go on the air, but NPR was hiring women to go on the air, and the lines of opportunity were very clear. The possibilities were clear and were pretty immediate.
Did you face any difficulties as a woman covering politics and covering Congress? Did the men, and it really was men then in those positions, did they take you seriously, or did they give you a hard time because you were a woman?
Well, you know, all of these things are relative. Now, covering Congress is almost women's work. If you sit down at the press table now in the dining room of the House or Senate, you will be sitting with, I would think, probably somewhat more women than men. Newspapers have women up there. Broadcast organizations do. But when I sat down at that table in the very beginning, you know, in the early 70s, I was very often the only woman there. And there were sometimes language I could use if Linda weren't here, or a joke I could tell you if Linda weren't here, that sort of thing. That sounds so old-fashioned, doesn't it? And there was a lot of funny stuff. You know, there were a lot of little ladies. I remember Senator James Allen of Alabama, for whom I had the greatest respect, and a great deal of affection because he was a real principled person. Senator Allen used to always call me Little Lady, and I would call him Big Senator, and then he would apologize for calling me Little Lady, but he truly just didn't think of it. You know, it was a generational thing, I suppose. Generally speaking, politicians are very modern people. You know, they look at me, and they see 15 million people are standing behind me, and I am I'm the thin edge of the wedge. I'm the listening ear, but 15 million people standing behind me will also hear. And so, you know, I could be, you know, green. I could be anything, and they would talk to me.
You said that there's probably more women than men now covering Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Well, yeah, I don't know why that is. I think I think it may be that in the 80s, Congress became a kind of boring thing. You know, it was completely gridlocked in the late 80s. Nothing was happening. The Democrats were in charge of the Congress, the Republicans were in charge of the White House, and there was, you know, and never the twain shall meet. Politics got very obstreperous and argumentative and amounted really to nothing. And I think that the fact that it was not critically important to our nation's future for a few years meant that some of the low people on the totem pole got sent to the Congress, and you know, in a lot of shops, that's women. So I think that may be it. Now it's a very interesting place. You know, now it is absolutely at the top of the news. And, of course, some of those women are still there, and now attitudes have changed toward who are the stars in our shop. You know, the New York Times, for example, has Maureen Dowd is their sort of commentator of choice on Washington these days. So lots of things have changed in the world for women at work. We have a number of reporters who cover Capitol Hill, but our national political correspondent, Elizabeth Arnold, is one of the, you know, sharpest and best we have. And, of course, we want her there when big things are happening.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. The book is not out yet, but it will be out in next month. Linda, you grew up in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I started hearing you on NPR, I just assumed you were from New York. Your voice just said New York to me. Obviously, I'm incredibly wrong.
Well, my family, no one in my family had a strong, you know, Western or Southwestern accent. And I have no idea why that was, because they were all from the West and Southwest. My father was born and raised in Louisville, Texas, and my mother was born in a wonderful a town with a wonderful name of Loco, Oklahoma. And so we're Westerners for generations, but I went to Wellesley College, which I suppose, where they did think that I had an accent, although they thought it was mostly on funny words. I mean, I would say things like fixing to, meaning I'm about to. Or once I said striped. And I didn't say that again. But there were, I don't know, we don't talk very Southwestern, I think.
I know your father ran a grocery. Did you have to work in the store?
I did. I worked. I delivered groceries on Saturdays and worked in the store in the summertime. I grew up in a town called Carlsbad, New Mexico, which is famous for the Carlsbad Caverns. Well worth the trip if you're in the area, and it is. It's not a very big place. And there's nothing close to it. You know, it's not like living in Evanston and being close to Chicago. It's 150 miles to the next sizable city, El Paso. And between Carlsbad and El Paso, there's not much. So it was a very self-contained place and very peaceful. And when I delivered groceries, I would just walk into people's kitchens, and if nobody was there, I would put their groceries, I would put the, you know, ice cream in the freezer and milk in the refrigerator before I left. And the doors were never locked.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, when did your parents start listening to you on the radio?
Late. My family, there were not radio stations. You know, the West was one of the difficult areas for us, just simply because of the size of the place and because population centers are so spread out. But Eastern New Mexico University put a translator up on the Cap Rock, which is a geological formation near Carlsbad, and all of a sudden you could hear it in Carlsbad. My mother lived in Texas in the last part of her life, and she could hear the station in Odessa. But it was really only just the last few years of their lives that they were able to hear what I did for a living, I'm sorry to say.
But they probably liked it once they heard it.
Well, you know, my mother did. My mother was very proud of what I did. My father was always explaining to me why it was that he was listening to, who's the man who says, page two?
Paul Harvey?
Yes. That he listened
you
to Paul
You lost out
Harvey.
To Paul Harvey.
I did.
Oh, well.
With my father.
Can you tell the story of the day you took your mother with you as you were covering your beat in Washington?
Well, in those early days, you know, when my parents weren't really able to hear the radio program, I was just so wanted them to know what I did and to understand it and appreciate it and so on. And when my mother was visiting here one day, I took her with me to the Hill, and we sat down in the president's room, which is the lobby off the Senate chamber, and I asked the doorman to ask Senator Muskie to step outside and for an interview. And he came, and I introduced him to my mother and said that, you know, she was visiting. And then we sat down and did the interview, and I asked him some sort of searching questions, and then he kind of equivocated, and I asked him a follow-up question and challenged him and so on. And I was being, you know, the reporter and being tough with the senator and so on. And I thought, wow, my mother is really going to see that, you know, that this man feels that he owes me straight answers and that I'm going to insist on getting them and that I'm going to get them. And he left, and my mother looked at me, and I was, you know, sitting there just thinking, wow. And she said, I didn't bring you up to talk to people like that.
So what was your reaction when your mother did that? I mean, you were trying to impress her, and here she is being critical.
Well, my mother had the ability. I mean, I suppose all mothers have the ability, but my mother was really good at making you instantly six years old. And all I could do was just laugh. It was just so funny. But do you remember in the book, there's an essay, there's a piece that Linda Barry did, the cartoonist Linda Barry, and she's talking about love. This was a Valentine's Day piece. And somebody says to her, Linda, why is it that you can look across a crowded room and you see somebody and wow, that's the person for you. And she said, it's the unerring ability of humans to enter a room and look around for the person who most nearly resembles their mother.
Linda Wertheimer hosts All Things Considered. She's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation as Heard on NPR. It will be published next month. This is Fresh Air. It's been interesting to look back with Linda Wertheimer on NPR's past and on her own past. But let's look ahead for a moment at the future of public radio. We're facing budget cuts, so during this fundraiser, your support is needed more than ever. What does your money go for? Well, for example, stations have to pay a fee to become a member of NPR. It costs money for this station to bring you programs like All Things Considered Morning Edition and Fresh Air. If you feel well served by public radio, it's in your self-interest to call now and ensure its future. Thank you. Jazz composer and saxophonist Julius Hempel died last Sunday in New York of complications resulting from diabetes. He was 57. Hempel recorded in settings ranging from overdubbed solos to big band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he'll be best remembered as the architect of the World Saxophone Quartet, which he co-founded in 1976. Kevin last heard Hempel play just 2 weeks ago. Kevin has this appreciation.
That's the World Saxophone Quartet in 1981, playing Julius Hempel's composition, One Waltz Time. That saxophone sound is Hempel's claim to immortality. He was the World Sax Quartet's main composer and conceptualist until he was ousted by his bandmates in 1989. Through that group, Hempel stamped the music of the many other sax quartets which followed, as well as other jazz, brass, and reed ensembles, and even some mainstream big bands. Hempel's distinctive chord voicings, luxurious and dissonant at the same time, have been an almost irresistible influence. Nowadays, it's hard to write for four saxes and not sound like him. Before there was a World Saxophone Quartet, Julius Hempel had made two classic albums of small group orchestrations, Dogen A.D. and Coon Business, recorded in 1972 while he was living in St. Louis. Hempel originally came from Fort Worth, Texas, the hometown of Ornette Coleman. Hempel didn't really sound like Ornette, but like Coleman, he caught the raw cry of a field holler with his alto saxophone. Also like him, Hempel found his own way to blend the earthiness of Texas blues with the woolly textures of free jazz. His cello player, Abdul Wadood, used his instrument like a blues guitar. In the music they made together, the traditional and innovative elements are equally obvious and equally right. It sounds brand new and rootsy at the same time. This is from Dogen A.D., which is long overdue for reissue. Thank you. that Julius Hempel has had his influence too, especially on younger band leaders like Marty Ehrlich and Tim Byrne. Abdul Wadood inspired lots of improvising cellists also. He and Hempel continued to play together occasionally. I believe the last album Hempel plays on is a set of their duets from Oakland in 1992. When Hempel left the World Sax Quartet, he turned his attention to a saxophone sextet he'd already used in his so-called saxophone opera, Long Tongues. Hempel told me last year that in retrospect, the quartet probably did him a favor by kicking him out. This much is true. By the early 90s, the saxophone quartet genre was sounding overpopulated and wearing thin. Having two extra voices to work with in the sextet gave Hempel a fresh start. As always, he had an uncanny knack for making the most unlikely chords sound plausible when played by saxophones. The Julius Hempel Sextet made two CDs, but Hempel had been ill in recent years and plays only on the first of those, called Fat Man and the Hard Blues. Recently, the sextet had been performing without him, but Hempel sat in with his own band for two nights in New York, 10 days before he died. He didn't play much, but he did take a few solos, and they were vintage Hempel. He still had that searing Texas blues thing that could always grab you, even if you didn't know he was one of the greatest writers for saxophones that jazz ever had.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Special thanks today to Norb Gallery, Gary Henderson, and Beth Howard at NPR for their assistance in getting archival material for today's program. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.